Hello and welcome. I'm Haney.
I'm Simon.
I'm Alexander.
We are knee-deep in tech, covering the latest from the IT industry with a specific focus on Microsoft and how to get actual value from technology. This is episode 263, recorded on the 23rd of April, 2024. You will be able to find this and our previous episodes on kneedeepintech.com, iTunes, Spotify, and on many other podcasting platforms. We are here again with some news items.
Yes.
We keep coming back.
Like a rash.
That is strange.
News keep coming, I'll say that.
That is definitely true.
Just before we jump into it, the other day I was talking to a friend of mine, and I just casually noted that, yeah, with Fabric, we're looking at 60 pages of news every month. And that's just one product. Stuff's happening at a crazy pace. And that's what I know, because there's so many things happening outside, like whatever Simon's working on, I have no idea.
Maybe you can tell us, Simon.
Yeah. But first, I thought we weren't in agreement with Fabric being in a product or a portfolio. Like, I more and more see Fabric as a Microsoft 365, but
we don't know.
We don't. We'll see. It's like all the copilots, they are multiplying.
Oh, it's like
or rats.
An intelligent data platform, you mean?
Yeah, but there was only one intelligent data platform, which made it like manageable. With copilots, they're popping up like Easter eggs. I actually looked into why we have a bunny delivering eggs, and that story were incredibly complicated and sort of odd and involved. It's unmentionable things between animals that we shouldn't talk about. But what we should talk about is two interesting, one interesting LinkedIn post and one interesting blog post, which I've actually have saved for weeks. So they are now getting quite old. But see this as my soapbox moment of this podcast episode. So first and foremost, I saw a great LinkedIn post by David F. I don't know his surname, unfortunately, but he's the deputy CISO at Bank of England. And he put out a LinkedIn post about patching, where he claimed that patching is not about security. It's something that we all should do. Vendors release patches for multiple reasons, and like the only reason why we see that patches are a security concern is that we do not patch to some extent, and that it fixes vulnerabilities and so on. And he made a long blog post about what happens if you skip patches, you incur debt. We might have discussed that in previous episodes, technical debt. When he basically says upgrading 8 patch levels introduces significantly more business risk than 1 patch level. I think we can agree on that. Your engineers lose the skills required to apply these changes safely. Agreed. The less often you patch, the harder it will be. And the business becomes unaccustomed to the activity and may push back. And then he continues with a lot of really good things. But he basically says that the way they manage patches is all about always patching as fast as they can, and that is part of the daily operations, and therefore they are very seldom out of patch compliance, which also helps them with support, because as you know, and he takes Oracle as an example, I assume it's the same for any software vendor out there, if you aren't on the latest patch level, you won't get support, which I think is reasonable enough. So read that. We will follow up with more patching things later on, but I think that it's a very good post, which made me happy. The second part is a blog post from the collective Go EUC, which is a group of incredibly talented and intelligent persons in the end user computing space, which do all sorts of fun things. Lee Jeffries is one of the authors. And the blog post headline is performance guaranteed on an Azure VM at all times? And that's really struck my interest. And he has done a lot of testing with IOPS, with a lot of things. And he could see like some patterns, even though it was surprisingly stable, actually, in his tests. So no, I don't think you should assume that your VM will always have the exact same performance. But in his research, it really showed that it's significantly more stable than you would imagine. That is when you have an Azure VM with a specific SKU attached to it. Now enter Windows 365, where you are only... No, the only thing you know is that you get a certain amount of disk space, you get a certain amount of CPUs with something, it doesn't state which kind of CPU it is, memory, and so on. Which means that it's very, very hard to know the performance you will get on a day-to-day basis, because it will change. That's something that even Microsoft states when you look into performance testing of Windows 365 or any Azure VM for the matter. Microsoft clearly states in their own blog post, it's really complicated to do synthetic performance testing on any cloud platform they claim, because things will change underneath. But I think that is something that we also need to remember, which to some extent could be different from purchasing these services from a traditional mm-hmm. vendor in a traditional data center.
What's your experience? We also need to have a conversation around what does performance mean in a specific context, because there's only so much that you can infer from having four CPUs and 48 gigs of memory. What does that mean? There are a few things that confuse me more than what Citrix used to do with remote desktop style things. It was not possible to get that blazing performance. It still is not possible to get that blazing performance through remote end using computing. It cannot be done, but they keep doing it. So yes, performance is hard here.
I don't even understand.
Me neither.
If they are good at doing what they do, or if they're bad at what they do. They are good. And I also think that we had a fantastic session, both at AVD TechFest and at other user groups last year, where two other of the GoEUC writers talked about what is user experience and went into things like, when do we experience that Teams is slow in a remote session? And to understand that, they needed to understand how our eyes work, how our ears work, like update frequency, and how to actually compare that in a synthetic way, which was incredibly interesting and also quite fun when they
do. What is the update frequency of your eyes?
30 hertz, I think, something like that.
Of your eyes?
Yes.
That sounds very low, but
yeah, but that's why we like that's why we have, when you have 24 pictures per second, that's when we see a smooth line at first, but we need to go up to 30 to make it real smooth. And that's also why you get all of these other fancy things with recording equipment and things when the hertz is
apparently between 24 and 50 frames per second. Interesting. Yeah.
That it varies is quite interesting as well.
Very much so.
Yeah.
well, it's a biological system.
Aren't we very easy to monitor and foresee as biological creatures? No.
No.
Speaking about which...
You've misunderstood something.
You still believe that I'm a biological creature. That is quite fascinating as well. You know, just terminate. Silence. But thank you for that great segue, Alexander, because the next news item is actually about Citrix, where Citrix a week ago announced that there is now a Citrix VDA, so an agent for macOS, which might sound odd. Haven't we always aimed to run Citrix on Mac? Yes, but now you can use your Mac as the host or the actual virtualized layer. You are still not allowed to virtualize Mac OS. But what you can do with the Citrix VDA is that you can install the VDA on a physical Mac and use Citrix to connect to it.
So that's going to be one desktop for one Mac.
Yes, exactly. It's not multi-session. You can obviously share the same Mac, but you can only be one person at the time. And you can't do... I think you actually are allowed to then virtualize additional Macs on top of it, but you are not allowed to connect to them because it's a one-to-one relationship as well, according to Apple's licensing agreements. So we have organizations like Mac Stadium, AWS have always or has also done this previously, where you could purchase physical Macs in their data center, connect to both with a user interface, but also from a coding point of view to do compilations and so on. But now you are able to do this with Citrix and in as part of your regular Citrix infrastructure and virtualize Mac OS and send that picture to something else, which I find quite interesting and something that I have a lot of customers that would find really useful because then they might not need to purchase and really expensive Mac for every single developer or whatever. They can have a like lighter Mac and then do the complete work on centralized Mac OS hardwares. Continuing on the EUC path, I will be really quick here. A lot of news for Windows 365 Enterprise. The two main things that I would like to highlight is that it's now supported to run HP Anywhere, so formerly Teradici, so PC over IP, with Windows 365. The difference, and I needed to ask Copilot about this, is that imagine you do remote desktop protocol, so RDP, that sends a screen picture every time something happens. So it sends a full picture of your screen every other second or so. I think it's 30 pictures per second. With PC over IP, it will send pixel per pixel and at a much higher quality. So you will get accurate colors and a much, much, much better quality of the picture, but you sacrifice bandwidth. So it will be a heavier protocol, but a much better picture quality. And that is something that, for video as an example, is sought after. You still need a Teradici HP Anywhere license to do this, but it's an option you have, especially for the GPU-enabled Windows 365s. I imagine that this will be very popular. And the last item is that we now have a buffer added for the Frontline Worker license. So currently, if you buy Frontline Worker for Windows 365, that means that you can buy one license and have three different people sharing that license. They are then allowed to one at a time log into a dedicated machine, and once their shift is over or something like that, they sign out and the other one boots up. Problem is that previously you couldn't start your machine if the previous one were started, which made it very complicated when you needed to change shifts. Now you have a buffer, so you can actually be online for an amount of minutes on your schedule while you're exchanging the VMs. And also a ton of other Windows 365 news items. But since apparently no one cares about what happens on the endpoint space, we will now move on to something a lot funnier, which might either be things that won't be there for that much longer, or optimistic jobs, which I tend to do every single day when I wake up. So who wants to be next?
As segues go, that might actually be one of the worst, but well done, yes. Simon.
This was my optimistic job. Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think that word means what you think it means, but let's go with that. So the fun thing with this one, it's about how Spark does job admission. It's not optimization. It's job admission in Spark. So I was talking to Johnny Winter. Grayskull, that's his nickname. He works for Advancing Analytics out of the UK. Pretty clever gentleman. You should have seen the tattoos that he and Craig got in Vegas when they were there. That was just hilarious. Yes, they went to get tattoos in Vegas, but I digress. We were talking about the way that Spark sorts job admissions. So Spark, a very, very quick primer, is this hugely parallelized processing engine, if you will. And you have a number of nodes and you have a number of jobs that you can throw at these nodes. And one would think that the best way to utilize Spark is to, well, there are a couple of ways. Either you can just give Spark one job and tell Spark, here, go ahead, turn this into a gazillion little pieces, give these to your nodes, and off to the races where you go. That's how Spark was designed from the beginning. And if you do that to Spark, it works brilliantly, absolutely phenomenal. It's designed for really, really heavy jobs, but not necessarily for concurrency. That does not stop everybody and their cat deciding that Spark is the way to go with all kinds of data-related things. So in many ways, we are forcing Spark to do things it was never designed to do. And then we run into pretty interesting concurrency issues. And one is that by default, or default is wrong word in this case, due to the way that Synapse behaves and Spark behaves, the Fabric used to behave, it has a what's known as a pessimistic job admission. And that means, in essence, that it's going to look at the number of nodes that it could possibly use and pretty much reserve those. Mm-hmm. And if you try to throw another pretty big job on a cluster, the driver is going to look at it and go, well, I can't guarantee that you will have access to all these nodes, so I'm going to reject this. With optimistic job admission, it essentially gives you up to 12 times increase, and it will prevent job starvation. So suddenly you can get much more done as long as you don't overcommit. That's not something that you can really control. That depends on what the Spark cluster will do, but it will at least get your stuff starting. And when there will be enough resources available, you might be able to scale up or down. So it makes all the sense. It takes away some of your control. You cannot know that you will get all the umpteenth nodes that you want, but at least it will give you something. And something, in most cases, beats nothing. And it is frustrating as heck to just go, yeah, no, can't do it. Sorry. So quite something to look at. It's an interesting blog post, and it will make your life 10 times easier when you're designing things in Fabric, for instance.
12 times easier.
12 times. Yeah, up to 12
that
times.
That is very specific.
They stated that in the blog post.
They did. You can read. I'm happy for you. The other part that I want to mention is the public preview of one-leg shortcuts to S3 compatible data sources. And S3 was designed by AWS, but it's a very standardized API. Just like you have storage accounts on Azure, you have S3 buckets in AWS. And there are a lot more things that are not necessarily cloud-specific that work with S3. Like you have the very common Hadoop file system, HDFS. That's what underlies most of the data lakes. S3 is sort of kind of like that. So you're going to find a lot of on-prem disk arrays that can talk S3, for instance. And that's where these shortcuts come into play. So the idea is to not necessarily move your data, or the point is not to move your data at all. Microsoft goes, well, if you have a lot of data in Amazon, it should stay in Amazon. You should just shortcut it into Fabric so you can use it as if it was in Fabric. I think the idea is fantastic. It's super cool. But you must spend a lot of time thinking about the consequences of this. We're back to what is performance. Because if your stuff is in AWS somewhere, it is going to be in another cloud, meaning that you need to go out of Azure, you need to go in to AWS, mm-hmm. and then you need to get your stuff. At the very least, you're looking at light speed latency. At worst, it might be on the other side of the world, but you cannot really see that from Fabric. You're just going to see the shortcut, and you might be lulled into a thought that, well, this is local storage. It nice. Might not be that. But the really cool thing is what they're mentioning in fairly small letters at the end of this. Coming soon, we will add support for shortcuts to connect to on-premises and network-restricted environments. This means that you will soon be able to use your Fabric on-premises data gateway to add data to OneLake from your on-premises S3-compatible data sources that are not directly exposed to the public internet. Now we're starting to see really interesting use cases for shortcuts. And again, I think the technology is fantastic. We will need to have a conversation from an architectural standpoint. What does it mean if your storage is remote? Because that's essentially what this is going to turn into. Sure, there is a cache. This one is pretty interesting. You can set caching per workspace in Fabric, which means that you have essentially your garden variety disk cache. So instead of always going to the data source, if you can find the data that you need in the cache, that's going to be the one that serves you. So potentially, if you have a relatively small amount of data that is used most of the time, you can have pretty decent performance. What we need to think about when it comes to these things is that nothing in life is free. You're not getting this for free, because somewhere you need to pay for this. And as I found out the hard way just the other day with Fabric Link for Dataverse, well, the data needs to go out of Dataverse and be stored in Dataverse before it can be shortcutted into Fabric. It's the same thing here. You still need to pay for storage in AWS. You can expose it into Fabric, but it doesn't mean that Fabric is free, because you still need to pay for the storage. I'm sure it makes sense when you think about it, but if you don't, well, it can again come back and bite you.
What is Microsoft's long-term play here? Because now they're making it simpler, and I like that. I think that's the position Microsoft should be, that sure, cloud you want, we will be the like commons integrator where you do all the lift and shift and all of that. I get that. And it's simpler to do this than migrating stuff over to Azure. But do they think that they will earn that much money from Fabric that it will be worthwhile for them to migrate or actually store the data from Amazon? Like, what's your thoughts on like the business long-term goal with this strategy?
So this is me just guessing from my experience, and that is that yes, Microsoft will lose the revenue from storing the data. But in many cases, I would argue that if they didn't offer this approach, they wouldn't get any revenue at all, because then the compute and the storage would stay in the other cloud. Now you can easily sneak in Fabric from the left. It's sort of kind of like what they did with Power BI. Power BI can talk to anything, meaning that you can still run your Tableau stuff if you want to, or Click if you want to. That's fine. You can still tag on Power BI on top using the XML endpoint. So I think that's the idea. We all know that Microsoft wants to take over the world in as much as they haven't already done so. So it makes sense. It makes sense, but it also means that all your base are belong to us. So careful where you put all your eggs.
Speaking about eggs.
So what kind of eggs does Haney have?
Well, I have a few eggs today, but I'll start with the one that actually we could say somewhat relates to the data side of things. So there is an interesting new capability in Stream Analytics. and it is that you can have a Delta Lake output from your Azure Stream Analytics. So we might not be in the scenario where everything is in Fabric. We might actually have some existing things still, you know, built on top of Azure. And one of the challenges with Stream Analytics has been that it hasn't really integrated well with these more modern approaches to saving data in more lakehouse type scenarios. So this is definitely something that tackles that a lot. So it uses the same Delta Lake format as is, for example, used in Fabric to define your tables. It is also used, for example, in Databricks as well and in other tooling like that. So it uses a native output connector that you can then point to an Azure Data Lake storage account. And then you can specify a path either to an existing Delta Lake table or create a new one as well. So you can choose which way you need to do. And the one thing to note here that it supports the append mode. So it doesn't do any kind of merging in your data. So this could be, for example, used for landing your data in Azure Data Lake storage. But if you have any kind of like merging logic or other kinds of logic that you need to do, then you would need to do that with other tooling. But really, if you have that real-time data stream coming in, yeah, and you just want to land that in your Azure Data Lake storage, this could be a really convenient way to do it.
Can I just point out a few limitations?
Yes, please. Just a few.
The date and the decimal types are not supported.
Oh, yes.
So that's just...
Isn't that kind of important?
It's kind of important.
Somewhat.
Yeah.
Somewhat, yes.
So definitely look at the limitations. Also,
yes.
Didn't the crazy Muppet, Simon Whiteley,
yeah.
He got a Muppet for his 40th birthday.
Oh, yes. I saw that.
So yeah, that's just... I think he just released a video on Stream Analytics and writing Delta.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I'm sure it's filled with snarky comments as well.
Probably, yes. And of course, I think as this is quite new, we will see it evolve with its capabilities over time. But do take a look at the limitations at whatever time you are considering using it. I think the one interesting point about this is that is used in a lot of streaming technologies is that you have these checkpoints that the Stream Analytics job creates, and that is how it's able to track like how far along is it, and also guarantee that, you know, only once delivery. So that's just used in a lot of differing streaming scenarios, some kind of checkpointing to figure out how far along in the stream are you actually. Then to more not so data related topics. It felt a little quiet actually for me with news this time. And I guess it's like May is starting to get closer and there might be some event happening in May, I guess. And it always seems that things slow down a little bit before a build. That's what I was referring to. But a few interesting things, what I've been noticing lately is that in the Azure updates, there's a lot of service retirement notifications. And of course, a lot of the time with those, it's kind of tricky because the dates are so far along. So like, are you supposed to just keep looking at it and trying to remember like when are things retiring and things like that? But I came across this one blog post that gives like quite a convenient way to be able to track the service retirements. So it uses a kind of a predefined notebook for this that you can find in the Azure Advisor workbook gallery. So it then pulls all the relevant data from Azure to then present you a list of the retiring services that are coming up. So something that could maybe make that process a little easier if you are expecting some of the things you are using already to be retired. And as the last thing for me, just kind of a convenient resource as well. So I personally work a lot with infrastructure as code in regards to Azure, and in a lot of cases, you know, the whole infrastructure management layer I've been implementing with either Bicep or Terraform. And just kind of an development on this side is that Microsoft has started to push this Azure Verified Modules initiative. I believe this came out sometime in February this year. And what their goal is to be able to create these modules for specific sets of resources that you would all kind of create together. So for example, regularly, if we take like a quite a common example is that you create a virtual machine and then you need to define subnets and things like that. And you always need those, all of those things. It's not that you most of the time would just create just a subnet, that it doesn't quite work that way. So it's the idea that it's possible to package these related resources together, and then you would just need to pass your variables to that module. So it is kind of also open for contribution. So you can bring in also like a module proposal that you would like to see for Bicep or Terraform. At the moment, they are definitely focusing on those two languages, Bicep and Terraform. We'll see where that evolves. But they also have a lot of guidance on the web page about what are they looking for in a module and things like that. And the idea is to also bring like best practices to what should a module look like, for example. And it's interesting because, for example, on the Terraform side, GCP has always had this modular approach to creating resources, whereas Microsoft hasn't had that. So now this is also coming in as one approach. So on the Azure side, you've most likely often come from the perspective where you create every single resource and maybe create your own modules. But then a lot of times you're like different companies are creating the almost exact same modules around. They just don't know about it. So I definitely see this could be something that can make the adoption of these kinds of tools easier in organizations. And with that, do we have any last words?
No.
So with that, I think we are ready for today. And next week, we will come back with a really interesting focus episode. So yes. Stay tuned. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to this episode of Knee Deep in Tech. Knee Deep in Tech is a bi-weekly technology podcast hosted by Alexander Arvidsson, Simon Binder, and Heini Hilmarinen. If you have any feedback, questions, or would like to be part of an episode, please reach out to us on social media or via email at podcast@kneedeepintech.com.